I like my music as over the top and melodramatic as possible. I'm not someone who likes like music that's like chill music, like background music. I need it to be like dramatic. And so this is perfect. This song is pure melodrama. And so that's what I love about it. It is not, it is basically like all the things people say about her, like, oh, she's so over the top. She's just like waving scarves around and leotards. Like that is this song and she's owning it. And it's fabulous.
And with me to discuss this song this week is somebody you will remember from quite a few other episodes this season, and it's always a blast talking to her. She was with me for the Lionheart album introduction episode, the Wow, 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 Unbelievable episode, Full House, and Kashka from Baghdad. And now from Brooklyn, New York, we get to talk with Zoe P. all about the last song from the album portion of this season, Hammer Horror. When she and I started talking about Kate back in October, she said this was one of her absolute favorite songs. So I went, okay, I'm putting you down for this one. And so here she is. Here's Zoe P. So, Hammer Horror.
Yes, one of my favorite Kate Bush songs of all time.
And it's not in a top 10 for me, but it is definitely an honorable mention. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Probably top 10. Yes, I would say definitely top 10 for me. Just the melodrama. I like my music as over the top and melodramatic as possible. I'm not someone who likes like music that's like chill music, like background music. I need it to be like dramatic. And so this is perfect. This song is pure melodrama. And so that's what I love about it. It is basically like all the things people say about her, like, oh, she's so over the top. She's just like waving scarves around and leotards. Like that is this song and she's owning it. And it's fabulous.
Indeed.
And so campy.
Oh, I see what you mean. Like this song, like so many other songs on Lionheart, is like a movie in itself. It's like a movie put to song, which is funny given the title, Hammer Horror, you know?
Yeah, and the title's so weird because I know you weren't talking about this, but so because Hammer Studios was a big British horror film studio. And so I will never understand why she called the song Hammer Horror, because she's explicitly said the song is not about Hammer Studios. And also in the song, she's describing a stage play. So that's a very interesting. I mean, it's a good title. It's like a catchy thing to say. So I get that, but I've never understood why she did it.
Me neither.
Yeah. And it's also interesting because like people always are, oh, you know, wondering why she didn't break through in America. One reason could be like a lot of her references are very English, and Hammer Studios is a very English reference. Like most American people don't know about it. I just do because I love lesbian vampire movies, and one of the best is called The Vampire Lovers, which is a Hammer Studios film. So that's, but like it's So that's the kind of thing where, like, you're listening to it, and you, as an American, you'd be like, what does she mean, hammer horror? But a British person listening to it in 1978 would know exactly, would get the reference completely.
Definitely. And it's also kind of like a returning to the haunting and ghosts thing that she had going on in Wuthering Heights.
Yeah, for I think the first time since then. And it's interesting because, I mean, we'll talk later about like how this song fared as a single. But I always wonder if she chose, this was the first single off Lionheart and didn't chart very well. And I'm not surprised because it's a very eccentric song. It's not like Wuthering Heights, even though it's deeply eccentric, has more, is more hooky.
It's more hooky, yeah.
This is more of a meandering melody. And so and it's even, like, the actual music, as opposed to the vocals, is probably even more over the top and while it can't be than Wuthering Heights. So I wonder if her or the studio, whoever made the decision, was like, well, it's about ghosts and haunting, and that works with Wuthering Heights, so we'll work for this.
Yeah. But it is, like, it doesn't necessarily have the big hook of like Wuthering Heights, where you hear that opening piano and it sounds almost like icicles or something like that. And this doesn't really.
I love the opening of Hammer Horror.
I do love I do love the opening too, because it's got these weird like minor and major chords against each other that kind of set this atmosphere of like tension and okay, there's something going on here.
So tense. Yeah, but it doesn't have that like core, even though it does have a chorus, it's definitely not as catchy as Heathcliff, It's Me, It's Kathy, I'm From Home.
Yeah.
It's so, and just, and also in terms of like the way the verses aren't as like immediately catchy either. Like, this is a song where, like, with Wuthering Heights, you hear it and it gets stuck in your head. I feel like this, you have to hear it a few times before it gets stuck in your head.
Yeah. It was released, though, as the, like we said, it was the lead single for Lionheart on October 27th, 1978. It was released and only got to number 44.
All the things of October.
And, you know, only reached number 44 in the UK, but it went to number 10 in Ireland, number 17 in Australia, which explains why she did that countdown show with Leif Garrett. That we'll talk about later, because oh my gosh,
it's so funny. Oh my god.
Number 25 in the Netherlands, number 21 in New Zealand, number 35 in Spain, and that's about the only places where the song even charted. It didn't even chart in the US.
Well, good for Ireland.
So it was a top 10 hit in Ireland. The Irish loved it, but the UK, not so much.
I mean, I think it's just, it's so wild. I mean, Wuthering Heights is also so wild and over the top. But this is almost, well, I remember the first time ever, I played it for my mom once. So I showed a video and she said, this is basically opera, isn't it? Yeah. So maybe it's something like that. I don't know. But I think that, like, if she had released Wow as the first single, like, yeah, that probably would have been more successful. It's also interesting because most people never release the final song in an album as a first single. So that's an interesting choice too.
Yeah, that is true. A lot of people don't. Because people go, oh, we want to hear the lead single, and so we're going to put it up front so that, hey, you'll have a reason to buy the album. Hey.
Yeah, well, she learned her lesson. Well, oh no. Well, actually, she learned her lesson with her next album, with the Babushka, but actually, the lead single off her third album, Never Forever, was Breathing, which is the last album, the last track on that album.
That is
true. Babushka, the first track on that album, then was the second single and was an enormous hit. So, yeah, that's a good point.
Oh, This Woman's Work was the last track on The Sensual World, and that was released as a single.
I think the title track was released as the first single.
Oh, yeah. You're right. Yeah, then Rubber Band Girl was the first, was the lead single from, you know, The Red Shoes.
Sorry, you laughed when you said that title, because I have feelings on that song.
Oh, So anyway, back to Hammer Horror.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was. Oh, and then also it's worth noting that the song was written when she was a teenager. So this is one of those Beat Kathy demos.
Mm-hmm.
And I know we can talk about later the differences between the full recorded version and the demo version, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, this was one of those written when she was a teenager. They went, "Hey, we need new songs, and hey, let's go use this one." Hey,
well, I mean, she had written over 100 by the time that she was signed at age 16, so she had a full backlog. Although she still should have used something else instead of In the Warm Room. So I'm still bitter about that. And Room for the Lights and Kick Inside. So.
And yep. And we've talked about that. I agree with you.
Yeah.
Yeah, what it's about. So it's an actor. It sounds like it's an actor who gets to play the lead in, sounds like The Hunchback of Notre Dame, because she makes little puns with
production.
Hunchback. And after the original actor, a friend dies in an accident on the film set, and the character narrator is guilt-ridden by his friend's death, and he's haunted by the ghost of the jealous original actor. Ooh.
Oh, film set. I thought for some reason I thought it was meant to be a theatrical production.
I'm not sure, because when I look at the lyrics, I interpret it as like as a film set.
Oh, interesting.
But that I could
that would
be
make
wrong.
Hammer Horror make more. Like, that would make the connection to Hammer Studios more direct.
Yeah.
But I always, when I read the lyrics, I think of the theater. It's like, I don't know, for some reason, because there's something about waiting in the wind. There's something, I think something about waiting in the wings. I don't know.
Let's see. You stood in the bell tower, but now you're gone. So who knows all the sights of Notre Dame. They've got the stars for the gallant hearts. I'm the replacement for your part, but all I want to do is forget you, friend. I assumed that it was probably like a film because of the Hammer Horror reference, but
yeah.
But I could be wrong.
That would make more sense then. Yeah, I mean, that would make more sense then.
And they have they've done many film adaptations of The Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Yeah. I think Hammer has. Hammer's known for their Dracula interpretations and their vampire movies.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they did all the Christopher Lee Dracula movies.
Mm-hmm.
It says you wrote that the song was inspired by seeing James Cagney playing the part of Lon Chaney playing the Hunchback. He was an actor and an actor, rather like Chinese boxes, and that's what I was trying to create. So that's something that was part of her inspiration, too. So that's interesting.
Yeah, the song is not about as many think Hammer Horror films. It's about an actor and his friend.
Mm-hmm.
His friend is playing the lead in a production of The Hunchback of Notre Dame, a part he's been reading all his life, waiting for the chance to play it. He's finally got the big break he always wanted, and he's the star. After many rehearsals, he dies accidentally, and the friend is asked to take the role over, which, because his own career is at stake, he does. The dead man comes back to haunt him because he doesn't want him to have the part, believing he's taken away the only chance he ever wanted in life. And the actor is saying, "Leave me alone because it wasn't my fault. I have to take this part, but I'm wondering if it's the right thing to do because the ghost is not going to leave me alone and is really freaking me out. Every time I look around a corner, he's there. He never disappears." And, you know, the song was inspired by seeing James Cagney playing the part of Lon Chaney playing the Hunchback. He was an actor and an actor and actor. Like you were saying, that's what he was trying to create. And that's from the Kate Bush Club newsletter number 3 from, of course, GAFA.org, because they have all sorts of stuff.
And that's such a complex narrative, because the kind of thing where when you hear the song, as I said earlier, it sounds kind of like pure vocal gymnastics and operatic.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really hard to actually know what she's, and this is for a lot of her early work, a lot of you don't really, it's hard to know what she's actually saying. And there could be a whole other podcast on misheard Kate Bush lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
But you kind of have to Google the lyrics to know exactly what the story is and exactly what words she's saying. Because when you hear it, I think it's just kind of such an over, especially for the first few times, it's such an overwhelming sonic experience that it's hard to take in the lyrics, at least for me, because you're just like, whoa, her voice is going all over the place. And it's hard to focus on what she's actually saying, especially because her voice going all over the place makes it hard to decipher what she's saying.
Oh, yeah.
But so that is like, that's a whole short story in itself, but it definitely took me a while to figure that out. For a while, I thought she was just singing pretty wildly about something spooky.
You know, I thought so too. I didn't realize that she was saying they've got the stars for the gallant hearts. I don't even know what I thought she was saying.
Yeah, there, I always thought she had the galaxy stars. That's what I always thought she said. I don't know. But yeah, it's really there. This one in particular is kind of hard to decipher what she's saying because it just is so operatic.
And I think at that part where she's singing, "They've got the stars for the gallant hearts, I'm the replacement for your part," I know that there's another vocal part under there, and I was listening to it again today to try and decipher what the hell she was saying, and I'm just like, okay, I'm just going to kind of give up and just, oh, this is just pretty little sounds.
Oh, you mean like the background? You mean like the backing vocals? Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, she does that thing in the backing vocals that she has a lot, where the backing vocals is making like chirping noises, basically. Yeah. So that makes it extra hard to figure out what she's saying in the lead vocal, because you're kind of distracted by the backing vocal. But I love that. I love that she's just piling everything on, and that's what so many people hate about her early work in Lionheart.
Well, I like it because you don't get a lot of that kind of like counter melody background vocal stuff in a lot of in a lot of music. You really don't.
No, her background vocals on her first two albums are like telling a whole other story. They're always tend to be kind of even like discordant and seemingly not even attached, especially on the Kick Inside, on Kite and Moving and L'Amour Looks Something Like You. If you play those songs really loud, the backing vocals are doing their own thing completely.
I mean, the only other singer,
random other noises.
And the only other singer I know of who really does that kind of stuff is one of my favorites, Charlotte Martin, who is also very influenced by Kate Bush, that she does in her song. She often has like a completely different melody underneath the lead vocal, and with her, you have trouble understanding what she's saying too. But
I think it's fascinating because it shows how Kate Bush, for her, the voice is an instrument, as opposed to with most singers, it's just what they're using to express their words. For her, it's this part. It's what part of what she uses to create the sonic landscape.
Quite a few people have said a lot about this song. this is from Melody Maker. The article Enigma Variations from November 1978 from Gaffa, they said, "Hammer Horror, the single, is most impressive for the way it seems to tie in so many of the finer points of the first album and project them through one epic song."
Yeah, epic is a perfect way to describe it. It's so epic. From the opening dramatic chord, final gong, it's just pure drama, never lets up. Mm-hmm. And that's your thing. Like, it's my kind of thing. This is your song.
Yep. And then from...
It's love or hate.
And then from... this was from a chronology of Kate Bush's career from Gaffa.org. On October 11th, 1978, from completing the final mix of the album, Kate is straight on to a plane for Australia, where she is to preside with that month's teen pop sensation, Leif Garrett, over the 10th annual TV Week King of Pop Awards before a live audience of 1,000 in a circus tent and a television audience of 2 million on the Nine Network. The next day, Kate also performs live on the television program Countdown, debuting the routine for Hammer Horror, devised in her hotel room. Hammer Horror is planned as the first single from the new album. And then on October 17th, 1978, Kate moves on to New Zealand, specifically Christchurch, for a television special. There she again performs Hammer Horror. And we're definitely going to talk about that special. Oh, my goodness.
I just have to wonder how big was that hotel room where she devised? Because, like, this routine requires a lot of space. I know this because I've actually tried to do it with an ex-partner of mine. and it took up a lot of space. Like, I had my partner be the male figure and try to like do with all the lifts and stuff and lifting me up. And I have to be Kate, of course. But you need a lot of space to think of that routine. So I'm like, I'm wondering at the size of that hotel room.
I know, especially if you're going to travel around. A lot of hotel rooms are not that big.
Yeah, seriously.
And so, I think when we get to the TV appearances, when we'll talk about the TV appearance of her and, the flavor of the month there. John Peel.
Other review.
Yeah. So John Peel said, quote, "I didn't like the album at all, and I'm not too enthused with this either." He said that on Radio 1's
Table
Roundtable. Yeah, it's not for you, dude.
It's not for you.
Paul Gambaccini says, it doesn't grab me immediately as the man with the child in his eyes.
That's a really weird song to compare this one to. I would think to compare, I mean, like, it's the one you compare it to is Wuthering Heights in terms of the melodrama and the themes and the vocals.
Yeah.
Like, the man with the child in his eyes is pretty much her most chill song up to this point.
Mm-hmm.
But he's been a pretty vocal fan and champion of hers, so I'll give him a pass.
Record Mirror's Ronnie Gurr, he said, quote, Kate keeps up the formula and doesn't upset the fans, dot, dot, dot. Sounds like Joni Mitchell popping tabs with the LSO formula song. What?
This is just like, that's just every male music critic, like, not allowing any female artist to, like, be themselves. Like, you have to throw in a Joni Mitchell comparison. This sounds nothing like Joni Mitchell.
No.
It does sound like someone popping tabs with the LSO. Not Joni Mitchell. It just shows the laziness of this male-dominated music critic world.
Yeah,
to just be like, yes, well, who can we think of? Joni Mitchell. Throw that comparison in.
They're like, oh, Joni Mitchell. She's this other singer who sings kind of high. Kate Bush sings high. Mm-hmm. Hey, they're the same, man. No, not really.
Exactly.
No.
They're both artsy. Ha ha.
Yeah. In NME, Tony Parsons, he wrote, quote, ominous post-ELO orchestration with the unrequited lust of a broken affair viewed as living dead love bites back in a classic 50s British celluloid, a real nail-biter, hypnotic and disconcerting. Broken affair? Love affair? What? No.
Well, that might be, like, as we were saying, he probably maybe had no clue what she was saying. He just kind of, like, took the tidbits of lyrics that he could find. But also back then when you had albums, you had, like, the sleeves with the lyrics, so, you know. But interesting in the review you mentioned earlier about Kate keeps up the formula and doesn't upset the fans, because I think Hammer Horror has a melodrama intention that I don't think any of the songs from The King's Side did. Like, it comes the closest to Wuthering Heights, but it's still tenser, because the narrator of Wuthering Heights is the ghost haunting someone, and here it's this person being haunted.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the paranoia and fear, which really comes across in the musical arrangement and her vocal style. So I get what he means in the formula in terms of, like, a offbeat short story type song, but I think that this is very different. Like, this would feel very out of place if I heard it on The Kick Inside.
Mm-hmm. It's got a real lush quality to it that fits that. Definitely fits in better with the Lionheart songs, because I don't know, to me, listening to all of Lionheart, including this song, I feel like I don't want to say there's really more strings in there. It's just there's, like, this more, like, if the backgrounds feel richer to me.
Yeah, I agree. They probably have a bigger budget also.
Yeah, and even though, you know, at the time, you know, she really wanted to, I think the impression I get from reading, like, the story behind this album and including this song is that she wanted to use her own band for the songs, but the producer, Andrew Powell, was like, no, I need to use my guys because they know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And she, I think, was really frustrated that, hey, wait a minute, I want to do a little more of my own thing. And, well, all I can really do is go, hey, Andrew Powell, I'm kind of thinking I want to do this kind of stuff. Can we kind of think about doing this, you know?
And she was dating her bass player. She's like, I want to be my boyfriend in the studio. Come on.
Yeah. In fact, I actually found this really cool quote. I went through the digital version of Under the Ivy, which I bought a couple months ago when I started this project, because it would just be so much easier to search for quotes. That she actually did a demo of this with the guys from the K.T. Bush Band, and they quote, when they recorded the demo for Hammer Horror at the farm, Bush insisted that she needed to be genuinely frightened in order to get into the role. Patty had the idea of blacking out the studio.
Method acting.
Yep, and having all these strange things going on outside, says Brian Bath. She started singing and Patty threw some matches past the windows and we made some ghost noises and she went, ah! She actually lost her voice. She couldn't sing anymore. She came back a couple of days later to sing it again, unquote. By now, her band understood and indeed were rather devoted to her eccentricities. She'd always have a very descriptive or illustrative version of how a song should be, says Bath. She'd say, I want it to be mysterious sounding or something like that, unquote. Pretending to be a ghoul in a blacked out studio was not, it's safe to say, the way that Andrew Powell preferred to work. However, to his credit, right. he listened to her ideas and agreed to at least give them a try, but he had little real enthusiasm for the idea of using her group. Quote, Cave really wanted her band very strongly, and I thought the easiest way to resolve something is to try both sides, which is basically what happened, he says. And that's from Under the Ivy.
Yeah. So, yes, interesting, because that shows why she then went on to produce her own works moving forward, because mm-hmm. she had, and this is, I've heard this about people working the Kick Inside too, saying that she basically came in with like everything about her song's plans and everything in mind about how she wanted them to be. So it's like, then she's like, well, then I'm going to do it myself.
So kind of our personal thoughts on the song, we kind of talked about already. Like, for me, it's not an mm-hmm. absolute top 10 favorite, but it is a very honorable mention. It is high up there for me. And I hear this and I think of when I was listening to it going on the plane to France in 2006, because I bought just the song on iTunes, and it was a big deal that there was even Kate Bush on iTunes. And so mm-hmm. I hear it, and I am reminded of being on the plane, like my first transatlantic flight, and I was listening to Kate Bush. Kate Bush was right there with me.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind
of cool.
That's
the my best Kate, even though it isn't Hammer Hall related, is a Kate Bush flight recommendation. Listen to Hello Earth when you're landing. Just saying.
Ooh.
It's magical.
Oh, I
it's
need to
corny.
Do that.
It's so literal, but that was a very amazing. That was a very amazing Kate Bush flying experience for me.
I am definitely going to do that next time.
Yeah. But that's cool. You have that association with the song going to France, for sure.
And just the whole of Lionheart. Like, the whole of Lionheart. Mm-hmm. Like, I bought it when I was... It was one of the first things I bought when I got to France. I went to the Fnac, and I got this and Never Forever. And I listened to those albums, like, sitting on my bed, looking out the window and at the... at the town and the winter sky changing, and I hear Lionheart and I'm like back to being 21 sitting in France, like listening to this on my
that's
CD player.
Cool.
And yeah,
wasn't it recorded in France?
And yeah, funny enough, yeah, this was recorded in actually in the south of France, even though I was in Tours, which is in like kind of the middle-ish, not quite middle-ish part of France. It's the part of France where you see a lot of castles. It's known for their castles.
Ooh, nice.
I know, so.
Very Kate Bush-ish.
Indeed, it was. I got to be around all sorts. I got to go in all sorts of castles, and I would always think like, ooh, all the people that have lived here, and ooh, ghosts. So that's my personal connection kind of to Hammer Horror, is that I'm reminded of being in France, and that's part of why I love it, because it was a really mm-hmm. cool time for me, and I got to buy, you know, physical Kate Bush albums because I couldn't find them in the U.S.
That is, oh, this country. Anyways, yeah, but no, like I said, I connect to it really personally, just because it really speaks to the drama queen in me, and it speaks to like why this album means a lot to me. It's just so over the top and queer friendly, and for me, the personal association is that I heard it while watching the music video. So I can't unlink the two, really. And I wonder if my experience of it would be different if I just had heard the song without seeing the music video first. Because, like, when I hear it, I watch the video in my head. Because the video, which we'll talk about later, is so wild and so memorable, and also completely owns my heart, because it is the campiest, most ridiculous, best thing ever. And, like, so, and like, my entire visual aesthetic is that video. But I always wonder, so I have a very like deep connection to it because I also have such a deep connection to the video. But I wonder if how I'd feel about it I would still love it, but I'm kind of bummed out that I didn't just hear it on its own first and get to appreciate it as a song first.
Yeah. For me, when I first heard it, like, it was not like much I'd ever heard before. And I honestly,
I don't know
why I just bought that one song instead of the full album. I think because at that point I was of the mindset that, oh, on iTunes, I can just cherry pick whatever songs I want. Mm-hmm. And, oh, this song sounds really cool. I'll just get this one to try it. I think because, oh, I know why I didn't get the whole album. It's because I had heard so many disparaging remarks about the album that went, oh, I'm not sure if I'm going to like this. I'll just get the one song. And then I ended up loving it. I think it was one of my most played songs at one point in one of my old iTunes libraries.
It's in my top 25 mostly.
I've listened to it so much. And for me, I watched the video much later. I think I didn't watch the video until, or YouTube or something. I can't remember how I first saw it. But yeah, for me hearing, I had the opposite experience of you. I was just going off the song alone, and I was like, whoa, this is not like anything I've ever heard before. Whoa, this is cool.
There's really very few songs in the world that they're like this. I mean, I can't imagine. Then when you finally saw the video, where you're just like, what is this? Oh my God.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because that video is... Oh, wow. Yeah,
I can't wait till we get to talk about the video later on, because, yeah, wow. And not wow, wrong that, song, but
yeah,
it is
wow.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
And definitely, it is a really good, it is a great ending to the album.
It's so climactic. It's almost like unusual. Like, it is a perfect ending because it ends with the gong, which like closes out the album. But at the same time, I feel like majority of albums I hear, including some of hers, you'll have the second to last song is the climax, and then the last one kind of brings it down. Like, for example, on Hounds of Love, Hello Earth is such a climax, and then More the Morning Fog is like the catharsis. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting how she ends it on pretty much the most tense and dramatic note possible. So it is the climax, then you end on that climax. And so for me, and also because it's a short album in general, you know, it ends, I'm like, that's it? Like, can I have some more?
Mm-hmm. But I do like the ending with the gong. It feels like, okay, boom, we've come to the end. Boom.
Yeah, just, I feel like it's the kind of thing where, like, you're listening to it in the dark, or like you're listening to it in general, and it ends, you just kind of like sit for a few minutes in silence and like absorb what you just heard.
And I, as with most of her early stuff, I love that. I love how theatrical the vocal melody is. It swoops up and down with the emotions of the singer. It's also in one of my favorite keys, G flat major or F sharp major. I love that. I love that key. Uses all the black keys on the keyboard. It's awesome. And it also continues her penchant for writing about rather dark themes.
Yeah.
I mean, she grew up listening to folk music, where it's not exactly, you know, family friendly PG kind of stuff.
Yeah, not folk music This Land Is My Land. More folk music like The Ballad of Lizzie Wan, Brother Cuts His Sister's Head Off.
That light. Yeah, definitely nice light family friendly entertainment. I mean, I've got a hunch that you're following To Get Your Own Back on Me. I know. Okay, so.
Well, she also grew up watching all these, like, probably even though the song wasn't inspired by Hammer Studios, she probably, like, saw a lot of their films on TV and saw a lot, like, just a lot. And on British TV, there's a lot of dark, weird stuff.
But the whole song is about somebody trying to get revenge. And I know that a lot of people have said that the line, I've got a hunch that you're following to get your own back on me, is a clunker. They're like, oh, that's such a clunker. I think it's clever.
Yeah, I never heard anyone say that. I know.
Mostly from Under the Ivy, he mentioned.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he calls it kind of a bad pun, and I'm like, I like it, though.
Yeah,
I think it's good.
He also doesn't like, but he also, no offense to Graham Thompson, he also doesn't like the Christmas special, which is the best thing of all time. So I don't agree, you know, we don't have to agree with everything he says.
Indeed. And that's okay. No, we don't have to agree all the time. And that's okay. Mm-hmm. I know it's, I think it's kind of catchy. Not definitely not catchy in the way that, say, Wuthering Heights is, but.
Mm-hmm. I mean, or even Wow.
Yeah, it's not quite catchy like those two songs, but I like it. It was enough
me
to
too.
Hook me into the album and go, hey, let me explore more of this stuff here.
Yeah, I mean, it's my favorite on the album, one of my favorites of the top 10 ever, but it's not something where if I hadn't known that it was a single, I would not have expected it to have been a single because it's just so out there.
Yeah. I don't even know, Anna, I can't think of what other songs from Lionheart could have even been a first single except maybe Wow.
Yeah, or like Symphony in Blue, although that's more in terms of the melody, it's more conventional. Mm-hmm. I think they just, you know, maybe I wrote either her or her studio bosses just maybe were like, well, Ghost, Melodrama, worked the first time, gonna do it again.
Yeah,
I feel like actually with Lionheart, as well as Alan Jerusalem 2, where none of them are really an obvious single at all. I mean, like, Don't Put Your Foot on the Heartbreak is like, might be because it's poppy, but like it also just is a weaker song in the album, so it wouldn't be a good idea to put as a single.
Yeah, that one doesn't really stick out to me as much. Don't Push Your Foot on
it's
the Heartbreak.
Yeah, it's kind of like this album's James and the Cold Gun, where they're like, okay, we need a rock song in here.
Mm-hmm.
Which is funny because they pushed that as the first single for James and the Cold Gun is the first single for Cake Inside. So yeah, we'll never know whether that choice to make this the single is her or the studios, but either way, it's a phenomenal song that, as you said, just doesn't really sound like any other song out there.
No.
Yeah, that's why when people like compare, like, I mean, Lorde's last album is called Melodrama, but I'm like, when people compare them, like, you think that's Melodrama? Take a listen to this.
Indeed. So, shall we talk about live performances, including this Leif Garrett appearance? Oh, my goodness. There's a name people haven't heard in a while, and probably nobody in my generation, not many people in our generation have really heard of, really.
I'm like a weirdo because I just know all like things that only older people know. But yeah, it's interesting because in Australia, if you go on YouTube, hopefully don't take it down now that I'm revealing it, is out there. If you just Google Kate Bush, Leif Garrett, well, and if you... since probably people don't know how to spell his name now, Leif is his first name, Garrett, or like Kate Bush, Hammer Horror, Australia. Because there's two versions on YouTube. There's one that only has a performance, but one with the interview and the performance. Mm-hmm. So basically, she's being interviewed with Leif Garrett together by this very kind of like brash Australian guy.
Oh, yeah.
And it's, so for context, you know, I was not alive then, but I know context. He was the teen idol of the day. He was like what the Jonas Brothers were 10 years ago, you know, like he was like the young Leonardo DiCaprio of 1997. And then meanwhile, she was very much seen as probably someone who's a flash in the pan or one hit wonder with Wuthering Heights, because Wuthering Heights was so weird that a lot of people in the music industry assumed, well, that's a one-off. But it's interesting because in hindsight, he actually ended up being the flash in the plan, whereas she became the icon, the staying power.
Yep.
So it's just kind of like the most surreal pairing of 70s icons, because they each signify totally different things. Like, he signifies like just like teen idol stuff, and she like signifies this whole serious artist thing. So it's really funny. And then I also love the version that has the interview and the performance, because in the interview, she's very clearly a 20-year-old. She is, you know, you can see she's so small. Like, when she stands next to everyone, she's like a head shorter than everyone. And she's very kind of like, yeah, I'm happy to be here. But like, very like, not timid, just not, she's, you know, she's a normal teenage girl pretty much. And then when you see her perform, she turns into drag queen. So it's such a 180 like that. It's so fascinating to watch the interview and the performance together and see her completely switch. Like, I will talk about this more in the video, but I think there are a lot of parallels in her and Beyonce. And that's one of the parallels I see, is that like Beyonce saying, oh, when I go on stage, it becomes Sasha Fierce. Mm-hmm. I feel like there's this thing where Kate Bush goes on stage and just becomes a whole other person.
Yeah.
And she says that herself. Yeah.
Hello, I met with Leif Garrett with his new single, I Was Made for Dancing, with those lovely ladies. No wonder. Have we got a show for you? This show tonight is going to make Ben-Hur look like a B-grade movie. And to start it off, I have one of the loveliest ladies on the rock scene, international rock scene, in the world today, Miss Kate Bush.
Hi.
Big cheer.
Mwah!
We've got a great show coming up, but I'd like you to meet someone. You probably met him last night. He is the heartthrob of every girl in this country, Mr. Leif Garrett.
Let's
go.
Can
you know again? Yes. Did you enjoy last night?
Yes, I did.
It was a very good night, wasn't it?
It was a good show.
You were great last night. You both were.
Thank you.
Yeah. Did you enjoy it?
I thought it was great.
Have you ever done anything like that before?
No. I mean, the audience made us move. They were just so excited, you know? It's just incredible.
And were you surprised with that sort of all those people going like that?
Yeah.
What about those girls sleeping in a telephone box outside your hotel? Well, I mean, goodness me. Is it true you brought them down coffee in the morning? This lovely lady on, as I said before, I don't know, did you see it in the dress?
I did.
Is stunning.
It's an incredible performance.
And to everyone at the ABC, I want everyone out there, Channel That's 7, right. Channel 9 and Channel O, to have a look at this, because this is great television. Here is Kate Bush
That's
presenting
right.
her new single called, like?
It's called Hammer Horror.
Woo-hoo!
Also, it's interesting, like, listening to the interview between this brash Australian host and Kate Bush. He reminds me, in a way, of Ryan Seacrest, I think, because he has this whole demeanor, like, oh, yeah, this show is all about me, and you just happen to be a slight hanger-on. Because he does most of the talking, whereas Kate's just kind of, like, sitting like, mm-hmm, 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 just, like, mm-hmm. just sitting there chilling off to the side.
Yeah.
Looking like, okay, am I going to get to talk then, sometime soon?
And, yeah, and then they're all like, and Leif Garrett is here! Woo!
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that didn't age well, so.
And you can almost see why Kate really doesn't do interviews, because, I mean, most of the time, these early interviews, most of the time I see an interview, the interviewer is like, oh, it's all about me. And instead of like letting you talk, it's like when we get to Hounds of Love and the Night Flight interview. Mm. Oh, my God. You know,
so the night Flight interview deserves its own episode. And I will host that. You know what my obsession with that is.
Oh, I know you will.
You know that like that is like I watch it on the regular, like pop in the popcorn. Like, that interview is, like, a whole other album, essentially. Mm. Like, it deserves that much attention, just saying. But, yeah, but I think with interviewers, a lot of the time, yeah, they do. And it's interesting because it's difficult because she doesn't really like to talk about anything other than her work. So she is kind of a tough interview, in a sense. But you can interview her in ways that are respectful of her shyness and her talking about her work, because there are there are some early interviews with her that are fantastic, like with the guy I mentioned earlier, Paul Gambaccini. There's a great interview with him around when The Dreaming came out, where he talks so much about her artistic process and her vision. And so I think that as long as the interviewers took her seriously, it went well.
That's when they started to go off into, oh, how many boyfriends have you had and blah, blah, blah. And she's like, okay, why are we talking about my love life? What the heck? No. And I don't blame
her. Like, will you ask Peter Gabriel?
Yeah. So that was on Countdown in Australia, aired or was done October 2nd, 1978. And then, of course, The Tour of Life. She performed it on The Tour of Life. And it was the only song that she did not sing live. And instead, they left a note on the seat, each of the seats in the theater, to let the audience know that the song was not going to be sung live. And
that's so over the top.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, like, you're right. An intricate, an understatement, definitely. Like, that kind of dance routine, you can't do that kind of dance routine and sing at the same time. Like, no.
And she's being flipped upside down, so.
Yeah, she's being flipped upside down and sideways and around. Like, there is no way that, and especially with your singing high like that, like, you got to, like, support your sound. And you can't do that when you're like, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, just, that's so, I'm just like, when I'm looking at the fact she left notes on the seats, that's so British. Like, I'm going to be polite and leave a note on every seat to know that it's just to let you know that's so British, and that's so also like over the top. So that's just so her. I love it.
Mm-hmm. But also, it's honestly, it seems a little quaint these days, because it's expected that if you are going to, say, a Vegas show, that there's really not going to be any, I mean, that there's going to be very little, if any, live singing, especially if you're going to go see Britney Spears. Like, she's going to be dancing and dancing. You're not there to see her or hear her sing live. Like,
well, and speaking of tours, I mean, the Tour of Life is what set that whole template. It was the first, like, Elton John said in the BBC documentary, the Kate Bush story, that she really set the precedent for all future tours to come, because she was the person who was singing, dancing, multimedia experience, spectacle, for pop artists who were not doing that before. So it's so many, like, everyone from Ariana Grande to Janet Jackson, who's sang with a headset mic and danced while singing, was Kate Bush, and they don't even realize it.
Oh yeah.
But it's funny. Yeah. It's so interesting. Like, anytime someone is performing on stage and singing and doing a choreographed routine with mic, Kate Bush actually was the first person to do that.
Indeed.
Like, people, it's like, you'll talk, like, when I talk about Kate Bush, people will say, like, oh, you're being hyperbolic, you're exaggerating. Like, no, she actually, like, the headset microphone was invented for her tour. I'm not being hyperbolic. It's true. You know?
And in fact, like, she had the band on, obviously the band was on stage playing, for this song, the vocals were redone. She re-recorded the vocals because they needed to, get around the musicians' union regulations. This is from Under the Ivy. It says,
what regulation?
Yeah, it says, this was the only song on the set not played or sung live. Instead, Bush and Van Last, I hope I pronounced his name right. Van Last is the name of the man who danced with her and also was the choreographer for the tour.
Yeah, Anthony Van Last.
They danced to a newly recorded version of the track. This was deemed necessary to circumnavigate musicians' union regulations and also to give the audience something with at least a whiff of live ambience in order to allow her to perform a routine of which she was very proud. Clad in black, the hooded Van Last slept out to shadow Bush on the choruses, a stark embodiment of both sexual need and a guilty conscience. Very physical, very powerful, very flowers, from Under the Ivy.
Sexual need, okay, I know where that's coming from, but male writer is going to male writer.
I've always thought of it as a guilty conscience, but...
It is.
Yeah, because he's like...
Again, Under the Ivy is still written by a man, so, you know.
Yep.
Just saying.
So yeah, the dancer she danced with was the guy who actually helped to choreograph her entire tour. And in fact, he was a dancer who was hired by the Hammer Horror music video director to dance with her, and she got along so well with him that they ended up she asked him to choreograph the entire tour.
And then he went on to become one of, like, the top British choreographers. He did, like, Cats and all these giant West End productions. But his career kind of started here, which is really interesting.
Van Last,
he's become, like, if you Google him, he's so well, like, renowned.
Yeah, Van Last went on to work on a number of high-profile productions, including Chess, My Fair Lady, and ABBA's Mamma Mia movie, and is now a knight of the realm. At the time, rather more humbly, he was a member of the London Contemporary Dance Theatre, and when not touring, he would often teach evening classes at the school attached to the company. It was from these classes that he recruited Stuart Avon Arnold and Gary Hurst, two young black dancers who would become Bush's principal partners on stage, in videos and in studios over the next decade or more. There was perhaps a degree of gentle provocation in her decision to choose, at a time when racial divisions in the UK were still pronounced, to dance with two black men. Quote, she does think about cultures a lot. Black cultures, Irish culture, Aboriginal culture, says Avon Arnold. She's very aware of color and creed.
Yeah, I've always thought she doesn't really get the credit. Like, people don't point out that it's kind of radical for this teenage. Also, things are very different in the UK, but in the US, if you're listening to this from the UK, in the US, there's this very loaded kind of dynamic about this idea of black men and white women the myth of the predatory black man. And so for this tiny white girl to be dancing on stage with two black men is actually quite a radical statement. I mean, it would probably be more so in America based on our racial neuroses. And even though England has that history as well, in America we're more hardcore about, there's more about the whole white woman, black man stigma. But it's interesting because they did become her principal partners, throughout this and then in her summer and in her videos.
Yeah, and definitely on the tour of life, they were the ones dancing with her and Kite and Strange Phenomena and all those other songs where she had male dancers. They were her guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's great because, like, this is for WOW, but I love how for WOW, when she performs it, she basically has these two guys, like, shirtless underneath her, like she's commanding them. And she's 20 years. I'm just like, this 20-year-old has these men, like, under her thumb. It's great.
Oh, yeah. Very badass, man. Of course, leads us to the music video. Because,
yeah,
of course, how can you
topic.
Not talk about this song and not talk about the video, which basically, for the tour of life, the routine was pretty much the music video.
But, like, times 10 because of the, like, ridiculous 70s special effects. Oh, my God.
Oh, like, yeah. Especially when she moves her hands and things are repeating. Oh, yeah.
anyone who fades themselves that often is just the most over-the-top human ever. And this is why she's so endearing to me. Like, she, like, this video, her dance routine in it is so ridiculous. If not the most ridiculous one she's ever done, and contributes to the image that people have of her as, like, an art school girl twirling and being silly. But the thing is, because she has said in so many interviews, the way that she performs in her routines and her dances are what she genuinely believes are best expressing the emotion of the song. So because it's so earnest and she truly believes that having a guy come under her and them doing jazz hands together is the movement that will best express the soul of the song, to me, that's just super cute and endearing instead of being just silly. And so it really, to me, this video encapsulates, and the song, especially them together, encapsulates who her artistic identity as in her early years perfectly, which is being ridiculous to the point of being beyond camp. Like, you can't really do Kate Bush parodies because if you watch a Hammer Horror video, that is a parody. You can't go further than that in terms of outrageousness and camp.
Oh, yeah.
And so it just gets to the point where I think you have to give in to her infectious past. Like, I think when I first watched it, I was just like, what the heck? Like, girl, like, what are you doing? But then you watch it over and over, because basically the way it works is she's dancing, but then this male figure with like a black, maybe I guess it's like a stocking or something pulled over his head. It's like, looks like a thing where you're robbing a bank, but without the eyes cut out.
Mm-hmm.
He represents the ghost who's creeping up on her and overtaking her. And he comes during the chorus and like, they start, it's hard. I can't really describe it. You kind of have to watch it, but, he starts like doing movements on, like as I said, like he puts his arms under her and they wiggle their fingers together, and she does that thing where you like cross your knees and your hands at the same time, and he does it with her, and it's so corny, but it's like so corny that you have to give in. You have to give into it, you know. And then he starts picking her up and throwing her around, and there's, it's interesting, at the very end of the video, he tilts her upside, after he's been swirling her around everywhere, he tilts her upside down and makes a gesture that he's choking her to death. And that's a very dark ending, because the song does not say the ghost kills the narrator, but here we see it happen. So that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there's also, as he mentioned, all the fades. They're so cheesy in the 70s, but like wonderfully so. Like there's like, I think the main parts are, for example, like when she'll fling her hands around, you'll see like fades of the hands. And then also when she sits onto the chair, you see her body like multiplied as she goes into the chair. So it's just like, she's so over the top, but it's just, to me, completely endearing. And if you like were to meet me in your life, you would understand. This video is basically my personal style and aesthetic. Like, I love her look in this video. It's like she's wearing this long gothic black dress with like wild hair and very over the top makeup. She goes 110% on everything. And I love that about her and this video. Like, of her videos, when she's off my favorite, I usually say like a four-way tie between this and three others. But this one has a very special place in my heart. Like, it's probably, like, if I had to pick one favorite, it's probably this. Although it's hard not to make it a tie between this, Sensual World, Sat in Your Lap, because that video, also like the weirdest video ever, but in a different way. And I'd say the Running Up That Hill video probably, and White Dress Wuthering Heights, because all the fades that we see here are also done a lot in the White Dress Wuthering Heights video.
Yeah, and then a lot of music videos of the time too. Like I've seen them in some ABBA videos.
Yeah,
they do some of those weird fades. I don't know what kind of effect that's called. If anybody knows what kind of effect, what the name of that effect is,
I read about it once. I think it's called a fade. So that's why I was using that term, but it might not be right. But it seems less like a fade and more like multiplication, because what happens is like she'll move her hand and you see like a like 10 shadows of her hand follow her hand.
Yeah, it's probably something you can easily duplicate now in like iMovie or like Final Cut or something like that.
Except people don't do it because it's a cheesy thing from the 70s. So,
but sometimes I like cheesy things from the 70s.
Me too. That's why I like this video.
Indeed.
But something I just don't see it. Like, I don't see it. You would never see it done in a music video today. It'll be that is ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. So let's see. There are several other versions of the song. I mean, there's Obviously, there was the live version, and that got reproduced for Live at the Hammersmith. The official video was on the official release. It wasn't one of those bootleg ones. Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting is they also used the music video for this as, if you haven't watched it and you're a Kate Bush fan, you must. If you look up Kate Bush Nationwide or just Kate Bush Tour of Life documentary on YouTube, they use the music video. It's a documentary about the making of Tour of Life, and they use the video to open the documentary, which is interesting.
I wonder if they did that because of it being the lead single from the album.
Yeah.
Figuring that,
that's what I presume.
You know, this is the song that people are going to know and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the live version. The single version, the only difference is that it omits the sound of the gong at the end of the song. A gong at the end of the song. Here, a little rhyme there.
Yeah.
And then there's the demo version that she wrote when she was a teenager. And for that one has lots of little lyrical differences.
Mm-hmm.
Like in the first pre-chorus, instead of the part about they've got the stars for the gallant hearts, I'm the replacement for your part, they say, or she sings, you knew the girls and the times, you knew the rights and the rhymes, now they're trying to push me into your name. Like, completely different there.
Like they're trying to make her, or actually, I think it's supposed to be a male character. This is another example of her taking on another persona. So they're like trying to make him subsumed into someone else's identity.
Oh, I never even thought of that.
Yeah.
She said the first line of the song is "Who stands in the bell tower?" rather than "You stood in the bell tower."
Mm-hmm.
In the chorus, she says, the first time in my life, the first break of my life where I've let him go.
Let Buck Go.
I don't know.
Yeah, because the first two lines make sense, but then now I'm like, okay.
Yeah, like, oh, yeah. The last line of the chorus, instead of, I don't know, is this the right thing to do? She says, it's not the right thing to do. So it just goes right into that.
So for the regular version, she's just like, he's a bit more ambiguous.
Mm-hmm. And she makes more of a
question. The narrator wants it more.
And there's the verse about rehearsing in your things. I feel guilty.
I feel guilty.
That one, that doesn't exist. The bridge, instead of the, I've got a hunch that you're following me to get your own back on me. Kate saying, you know my mind and my heart, so you should know I wouldn't take your part.
Hmm.
Which I find interesting.
Maybe the ghost is more malevolent in the because in the final, like, I can't tell which version the ghost is, like, crueler in, because in the demo, it's like, well, you know my heart, you know I wouldn't do this, but you're haunting me anyway. That's not very nice.
Yeah.
But I think it comes across, because, like, the rehearsing in your things, I feel guilty, it comes across in both versions that the ghost is being a little unfair, because the person, the narrator feels bad, but in the demo, they seem to have a more personal connection of some kind.
Who calls me from the other side of the street? And who taps me on the shoulder? friend of my heart. So you should know I wouldn't take your part. All I want to do is forget. You friend, have a friend, have a friend, won't leave it alone. The first time in my life, the first break of my life, I let go.
Like little changes, and mm-hmm. I'm not sure which version I like more lyrically, because you know this one, you're right, like the demo version, it feels more like you get more of a sense of a personal connection that the narrator has with the ghost, but mm-hmm. I like the album version because it feels a little more ambiguous.
Me too. And I love the rehearsing in your things, I feel guilty, like stanza so much. Mm-hmm. Well, more the way she says it or sings it or really like wails it.
Yeah. Rehearsing in your things, I feel guilty.
No, it's like rehearsing. It's like, you know, all over the place.
All right, so we're closing out this episode, and Lionheart, we have made it to the end of Lionheart, and already like, oh my goodness, wow, what a project.
Well, hopefully people who are listening have gained a new appreciation for this really underrated gem.
Indeed.
I mean, it's like pretty much every Kate Bush best out to worst album ranking, you'll always see this one at the bottom. For reasons that we've discussed through multiple episodes, we both seem to think that's deeply unjust,
mm-hmm.
And very much tainted by the fact that most the music industry is dominated by straight men and straight white men. But I know there's so many people I know, actually know quite a few people who say I do like Lionheart better than Kick Inside. I don't know if I do. I don't think I do. I think it's equal, or like, I like this one a little. I think I prefer the Kick Inside, but. But Lionheart speaks to, especially LGBTQ identified people, in a more direct way than some of her other work, and to me that makes it really powerful. It's really, this album really encapsulates everything that people who hate her hate about her, and what people who love her love about her. And so that's like, I feel like this album is such a litmus test for like. Like how over the top and campy are you of a human being, you know? Like, but the thing is, I think that the campiness shouldn't be mistaken for silliness, mm-hmm. or not being serious, but also she, even though she is being serious, she also has a sense of humor. She doesn't like, she can, for example, when Faith Brown, a comic from the time, used to do parodies of her, she loved them. She wrote Faith Brown a letter saying how much she loved them, and she talked to an interview on TV about how she thought it was so funny. So she, like, Kate Bush does have a sense of humor about herself. So Lionheart is just an album that is extremely polarizing because it's so over the top, and where you fall in that divide, I think, kind of says a lot about. It doesn't say whether or not you're a good person or a bad person, not like that. But I think wherever you fall inside the divide kind of says a lot about your taste in general. Not like saying if you have good taste or bad taste, just what your taste happens to be.
Pretty much.
Like a lot of people who hate Lionheart, like will love, are the people who think that the Ninth Wave is her best work, or who like her like just more, or like will like the Red Shoes a lot or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, Kate has a lot of wonderful music, and yeah, this album, I am really glad that I took a chance, and I bought this album for less than €10, Little Lonely American Girl, Wandering Into Fnac, getting this
was
in
CD?
France. It was a CD, and I still have that CD copy. In fact, I'm staring at
it. Oh, that's so
right
great.
Now. I got an actual like CD copy of it, and I listened
to it. I really
to that.
Want the vinyl because the artwork is so good. Did we talk about the artwork? Because the artwork like encapsulates everything that makes this album so polarizing and ridiculous and wonderful.
I love the artwork on this album, and especially like the cover. Like the cover.
The cover
is so iconic, and like in all of it, and it was shot like it was shot in somebody's attic, and it kind
of. I think her parents.
Yeah, and it looks to me like you look at that. You look at the picture on the cover of Lionheart, and I almost get the sense of somebody playing dress up. And in a way, that's what she's doing on this album. Yeah, like every song is her playing the role of somebody else. And dressed up as a lion, it's the perfect, like, yep, this is what this album is about. This is Kate's, I'm going to go play dress up and tell all sorts of interesting stories.
Yeah, and with her, she's always so literal about everything. Like, for example, when she's for her dance routine to Wuthering Heights, when she says it's so cold, she does a shivering motion. Mm-hmm. It's like, of course, for an album called Lionheart, she would actually pose as a lion because she takes everything completely literally. She's one of those people, and I'm guilty of this, where you said, like, oh, do you know the word literal is in the dictionary? Like, isn't in the dictionary? She'll be like, it isn't, you know? Yeah, so she's posed, she's in a lion suit. This was photographed by Gerard Mankiewicz, who did the infamous photograph of her around when The Higginside came out, where she's in a leotard and you can see her nipples, and they were on billboards and buses in London and made her this big British sex symbol. So Gerard Mankiewicz did the album cover for this, and she's in, like, it's almost like, you know, like at Disney World, like the animal costumes with the heads. Like, she's basically wearing that, but this is the lion head off. And her hair is, like, crimped to the 10,000. Mm-hmm. And she's looking into the camera just, like, basically with the look of a woman who does not give a damn what you think. You know? And I love and I love that. She is just fierce, literally, as a lion. She's literally a lioness. Her hair is done to look like a lion's mane. And she is as feminine and high-pitched as her voice is. On that cover, she is fierce and just like, you can't mess with me.
Mm-hmm.
And like, it's a cover that's kind of actually made fun of. But like, again, it's one of those things where she does work so ridiculous that you're either going to just think, like, roll your eyes at it or just be like, you know what? This is so ridiculous. I'm just going with the flow. One of her most famous quotes is, it's not important to me that people understand me. So that kind of says it all.
But yeah, I hope that everybody listening has definitely gained a deep appreciation of this album. You know, talking to you and talking with other folks throughout this season, and it's plain to me that actually quite a few people really do appreciate this album and agree that it should be talked about more. Oh, definitely.
Yeah, and like, I'll just say, anyone who ranks Kate Bush albums and puts this last when director's cut exists, I don't know. I just don't. You never understood Kate. You never even really tried.
If you have a couple of favorite Kate Bush songs, or if you just have one absolutely favorite song that you would love to talk about on a future episode, or you know something about this week's song that we didn't get to, you can either email me, kbcast@linkmedia.com. That's link with an E. You can tweet at me, twitter.com/strangekatecast. And you can also like my Facebook page, facebook.com/katebushpodcast. We would love to hear from you. And we'll see everybody next week for the first Lionheart Era Tracks episode, where we'll be talking about a rather obscure song. So it might be a shorter episode, all about the song The Magician. See everybody next week. And also that way, like, she was able to really tinker at her own pace mm-hmm. and not have to, like, eat up studio time. And I've just from my own experience, one time I needed to go and get myself professionally recorded for a choir that I was trying out for in high school. And it was expensive just to do 1 hour of me singing a cappella at this really mm-hmm. big studio. That was expensive. Well, and I can only imagine how much it cost back then, especially because now when I went in the early 2000s, he was using Pro Tools and it was all digital. And this back then, it would have been all to tape. Yeah. And that's expensive.
Well, that's why she ended up building her own studio when she made to make Hounds of Love, because during the making of The Dreaming, and this is described in Under the Ivy, the biography mm-hmm. by Graham Thompson, during the making of The Dreaming, she kind of had to be a nomad and travel from studio to studio, and it was extremely expensive. So that's why she ended up building her own that she used from Hounds of Love onwards.
Yeah.
And now she has, like, her own recording studio in her home in Devon. I don't know the address, but one day.
I only have to wonder, though, like, how many other songs has she recorded and just not used? Since she's at her own studio, she can do her own thing and she can release whatever she wants. God.
True. We'll never know. We never will.
No.
Because she's the kind of person who would be like Emily Dickinson, who would be like, burn everything when I'm gone, you know?
Mm-hmm. Including what supposedly there was a title track for Never Forever, but nobody can really remember what it is.
No one knows it.
Anyway.
One day we will know. And no one can find... Because the two songs that she recorded for The Kick Inside, basically like the first original ones, were The Man with Child's Eyes, another one called Maybe. Mm-hmm. And those are the ones that were on the demo she submitted to David Gilmour, who submitted to EMI. But nobody can find Maybe, which is so sad because everything else from her demo, unreleased stuff is available. Yeah. So interesting.
So,
back to Hammer Horror.
As I would say with my French students, say, let's get back to our sheep, or we'll get back to our sheep.
Yeah.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Frenino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.